Gurkha officer, once former field director of the Gurkha Welfare Trust. Now he's a professional photographer and brings these two things together to devastating effect in a book called Light and Life in the Middle Hills, which celebrates in photographs the life of those Nepalese communities and how they suffered and recovered from the earthquake, raising whole villages and buildings last year. Just tell me first about your Gurkha time. You joined the army. Did you ask to become a Gurkha officer?
No, I didn't join the Gurkhas when I started. I joined a big organisation called the Royal Corps of Transport. I was a rugby player when I was at school. Academically, I was terrible, but I was a good rugby player, and that sort of opens a few doors for you, which was lovely, much to the angst of many of my friends. But I played rugby for England at under 19, and I was playing for the Saints Northampton First 15 at the time. And because rugby wasn't a professional game then, I needed to go and do something to earn some money, and the army allowed me really to earn some money and keep fit and play rugby.
So how did you come towards the Gurkhas, and what was it like when you did?
Well, at Sandhurst, of course, the you have a demonstration company there, and they demonstrate the tactics for you, and they're all Gurkhas. And I saw these guys, having never sort of been introduced to them before. I thought, you know, this is fascinating. I'd rather like to be a part of that. And so that sort of sowed the seeds for me. And then I basically continued playing rugby until about 1997. And then I transferred to the Queen's Own Gurkha Logistic Regiment in the year after, and went out to Brunei to join the 2nd Battalion of Royal Gurkha Rifles.
When you were a Gurkha officer, what was the quality about the Gurkha soldiers that attracted you?
Well, yeah, I mean, they are very different to British soldiers. I mean, there are very few discipline problems. You know, it's a joy commanding Gurkha soldiers because, you know, as a British officer up in Liverpool or some other places where you're drawing your soldiers from, you have a lot of discipline problems. That's the sort of nature of soldiers, really. But as a Gurkha commander, then you really didn't have those issues. But their fighting spirit was incredible. You know, when a Gurkha soldier passes out when he's finished his initial training, he will serve his full time, whereas again with British soldiers they tend to do sort of between sort of 3 and 6 years. A Gurkha soldier, you get a huge return on investment.
You go a bit in the book, we can't go into the whole history of it here, but how the British Army kind of spotted quite early on that these could be the most amazing recruits.
Yes.
in the Commonwealth, you know, that these were belligerent but disciplined and strong, sort of small, strong people.
Yes, exactly. I mean, last year was the 200th anniversary of service of Gurkhas with the British, and it's that historical story where, you know, we started off in the Anglo-Nepal Wars fighting against them, and we thought they were so good that we really ought to have them on our side.
Real colonialism. Yeah, so you're 15 years an officer and then you worked with the Welfare Trust. I just should mention in passing that you became a leading elephant polo player during this period. A bit different from rugby.
Yes.
Not tackle them, basically.
No. You don't go anywhere near where their feet are when you're playing. But no, every year there is a world championship in Nepal, and I've played for the last 4 years. It's good fun, raises a lot of money for elephant welfare.
So there you are, you kept up your contact with Nepal ever since. You learned the language as an officer, didn't you?
Yes.
Not everybody does, but you got a bit closer to...
Yes, and you know, I mean, it is a wonderful thing to be in a country like Nepal, and I was lucky enough to walk most of the sort of east and west of Nepal on foot. There are lots of roads sort of growing up in Nepal now, but it's still nice to sort of do it on foot. But to go into a village and to be able to speak Nepali with them, you just get so much more access than you would do if you were a tourist travelling through there. And you know, a lot of the photographs I've got in the book, you see them in smiling situations, and that's something that I think if you didn't speak the language, it'd be very difficult. Although they want to, and they're, you know, they are very lovely and charming people, it's much easier if you can say something in their language to get them to react.
So the book begins with all these rather wonderful celebratory portraits of people, individuals, great character, looking out at your children, laughing and so on. And then we come on to the time of the earthquakes. You were out there really straight after that, weren't
you? Yes, about a week after.
And, I mean, devastating. You grew up on a farm yourself, and you saw what had happened to livestock and people's livelihoods. It must have felt extraordinary, having known them so well before.
Yes, it was. Yeah, I certainly arrived there with a great deal of trepidation because I didn't really know what to expect. I'd been up to the villages that were at the epicentre before the earthquake, and I went back to Barpak, which was the very epicentre of the earthquake, and there was just one building left standing in this town. You know, it's a sort of shopping town, sort of heart of the community of lots of other villages, and all the villages around and Barpak itself were completely flat.
School's gone, temple's gone, yeah, yeah. Just rubble. Fallen everywhere.
You know, fortunately, the earthquake happened at midday on a Saturday, so most of the young were not in their houses, and the adults were out sort of tending their crops. So it was a lot of the elderly that were killed that were in under the slate roofs of the houses that were out there. There was still a strong smell of death around the place, but that was mainly, I guess, from goats and cattle that had been killed.
There was interesting insight in the book from a psychologist and a medical team who were used to earthquake recovery and who came out there, and they found the Nepalese villagers were different from other post-earthquake communities like Haiti. There was something different about their response.
Yeah, and I think what I've tried to portray in the book is that sort of feeling that these people are really sort of carved by their surroundings. You know, they are very robust people living very austere lives. Particularly, you know, if you're outside the Kathmandu Valley, then there's not a lot of support that you get. And so they're very good at relying on themselves. And so I bumped into this Malaysian team, of which one of them was a psychiatrist. And she was saying it's just amazing the difference in response at this point, so soon after the earthquake, where the Nepalese are just sort of getting on with their lives, getting on tending their crops and making sure that the remaining livestock are good to go. And of course, it was just about to hit the monsoon season, so they knew that they had to get going pretty quickly because they knew that government support wasn't really going to be there very quickly.
There's a local expression you quote. I don't know how to pronounce it. Kegarni.
Kegarni.
Kegarni. Explain about Kegarni.
Kegarni literally means what to do. And you see this everywhere. Basically, if something has gone wrong, then the guys will just put their hands up and say, Kegarni. You know, what can we do? We've just got to get on with things. And they are terribly, terribly good at it. It's part of the reason they make such good soldiers, because you can put a Gurkha into a situation that's really tricky, and they will just get on with it without
all that. A bit like the French expression, on se débrouille, you know, get out of this one. Brian Mullen is nodding, what is to be done? Does this resonate with your aunt?
I just think at a certain point, you know, acts of God, somebody's got to pick up the pieces, don't they? And just kind of do the work amongst the people and rebuild is really important.
Yeah, absolutely.
What individuals, I mean, we talked briefly about these photographs, but what individuals stand out for you from the stories and the people you've met during this time?
Well, I mean, the amazing thing is that the elderly do old age so well out there if they can get there. So, for example, the Gurkha Welfare Trust has a couple of residential homes in Nepal to look after those that would have died had they sort of remained out in the hills. And every so often, you know, I'm sort of friends with them on Facebook, so I see the pictures of these old guys. They're all over 80, some of them close to 100. And, you know, for a day out, they will go and walk up a hill. And these aren't just, you know, rolling hills in Surrey. These are hills. And they will sort of disappear with their carers, who are sort of helping them up the steps. But they will go up these hills. And it's just amazing to see this sort of fortitude, smiling, laughing. It's a wonderful thing, that sort of sense.
One old man claims to be 104.
Yes, he was struggling a little bit with his memory. He was only 102 when we checked his military records. But so I think we'll give him the... give them the benefit of the doubt on that one.
So, I mean, you're a photographer, so the visuals are very important to you. The fabric of these traditional villages and in fact of Kathmandu itself, marvellous buildings. Are they going to be able to reproduce this, or are we going to have desperate flung-up modern stuff?
I hope so. I mean, they've had basically $4 billion in aid, sort of post-earthquake that's come in. They haven't spent a lot of it yet, the government. But hopefully that will start to flow out at some stage soon. It was very interesting when Prince Harry was out there recently. He was doing some woodworking with some of the guys who are going to be doing some of those woodworking skills to replace all those old temples in Kathmandu.
So are the skills still there? I mean, are there still the people who...
Yeah, they're very good at wood carving. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the word Kathmandu, cat, means wood. And Mandu means temple, so it's wooden temples. That's the very nature of the city. But it lost a lot of those really old wooden temples. A lot of them are still standing, and a lot of them can be sort of put back together, but they've got a serious amount of rebuilding to do.
As in all your travels, have you ever ended up in Nepal?
No, but there's a place
there
called Jomsom, I think, north of Annapurna, is that right? Which has got a couple of hectares of vines at over 9,000 feet. And I was sort of rather hoping you'd be able to tell me what the wine was
like. I haven't been. I will go next time.
Yeah. It's a thrilling idea, because all of those Himalayan foothills, right the way across to Kashmir, they're saying that there's so many places, given the politics and the religion and all the rest, that could actually make rather wonderful wine, particularly in a warming climate.
Well, they grow a lot of tea, obviously, in Ilam. I don't know if tea and vines...
I'm not sure they're in quite the right conditions. Okay. But the general idea about tea is you need the same kind of thrill and excitement with texture and perfume and flavour. And you know, if ever I had to give up drinking wine, I think I'd go straight into tea. Tea is absolutely fascinating.
Have you got up there yet, Emily? Earthworms in the thin soil?
No, I'd love to go, because actually no one, again, is studying the earthworms in Nepal. Actually, I got contacted by one chap who's trying to do an ecological study, and he needs to have someone help him with the taxonomy. So there is a chance I might be sent some of the worms from Nepal, but so far there's only 11 species recorded, which is, absolutely nothing.
I'm going in there.
Brilliant.
Start a convent up there.
Johnny will help you with the language. Do you know what an earthworm is in Nepalese?
Oh, I haven't got a clue. Samp is snake. That's the closest I can get.
What a glass of red.
Never mind.
Yeah, okay. Rataraxi.
Rataraxi, I'm noting
that. Rataraxi.
Let's turn to Oz Clark. Doesn't need much introduction. Wine writer, critic, famous palate and describer of wines, familiar from the telly. But he can also sing and knows music. A choral singer, and he was Sweeney Todd, and he was General Perron in Evita. And is bringing his gifts together in a thing called Drink to Music, a festival tour with the Baroque harmonica consort, which starts next week, and a couple of soloists. I mean, are we talking about refined Libiamo, or Yo-Ho-Ho in a bottle of rum, or a bit of both?
I hope we're not going to too much of that, because I think that some drinking songs are some of the worst songs ever written by some of the best composers, and we haven't really got any drinking songs at all, I think. I mean, someone like Purcell manages to get some decent writing done when he's talking about putting drunk people singing. But you know, in an opera, when the chorus starts all going, downing their flagons of foaming ale, you think, oh God, there's a drinking song coming up soon. That's the time you go and have a sort of quick break in the bar before and come back at the end of it. This is much more likely to be the fact that composers, I mean, I don't know how they ever got any work done that lot, you know. They all seem to drink like absolute fishes. Purcell was always at it. Handel was always at it. Gluck was always at it. I don't think, maybe Bach wrote so much because he didn't seem to drink, but we can't find any records of Bach drinking. I don't think he had time to drink the amount of stuff he wrote.
Well, we chose a bit from your programme of Purcell, actually. This is the scene of the drunken poet. Let's have a moment.
I do confess.
Forewarning about the dangers of alcohol here, but my heart's just not in it just now. But you say that the lives of composers are riddled with drink. I couldn't work out how you got Gluck's Eurydice song into it, but you have.